I'm very pleased to welcome to the final episode 13 of the Catalpa Escape podcast series, Margot O'Byrne. Welcome, Margot.
Thank you, Michael.
I'm trying to sound very formal, if not a little tearful. We arrive at the very last episode of this fascinating podcast story. Margot, I know you know, but I should just say to our listeners who have been following us all the way through that today, as we make this podcast, it's the 17th of April, 2026, exactly 150 years after the Catalpa got away from Fremantle with the six political Fenians aboard. It's amazing, isn't it, that it's 150 years ago.
And Michael, we've been doing this for nearly 12 months, and we didn't plan to end it on this day, but here we are.
Well, word, not just about the podcast series, Margot, has got out, but generally speaking about this amazing Catalpa escape. The Catalpa Fenians were formally honoured in the Irish Parliament just 3 days ago on the 14th of April, ahead of the 150th anniversary of the Catalpa escape or the Catalpa rescue, depending on which side you're looking at it from. During the Irish Parliament's order of business the other day, it was read out a cross-party resolution recognising the six rescued Fenians, their harsh imprisonment in Fremantle penal colony, the bravery of Captain George Anthony and the crew who rescued them and refused to the British demands to surrender the men, the role of John Devoy, Clan na Gael, John Boyle O'Reilly, and the Irish American network that organised the rescue, and the parallel rescue mission led by Dennis F. McCarthy and John Walsh under the guidance of the Fenian leaders in Ireland. Those two, of course, turning up late in the piece and then having to quietly sneak out before they got arrested, I suppose. Margot, it's wonderful that the Irish have come to the parties in a sense like this. Not surprising, but have you learned any more about what's been going on in Dublin?
Yes, well, there's been a big campaign. So one Frank McGavin, who was out here in Fremantle for the Fenians Festival earlier on this month, has been a strong advocate to the Irish Parliament to get this recognition. And Joanna Robertson, also from Cadogo here, has also been advocating, and various others. So it's wonderful. And I understand just this morning I received an email to say that there are some flags that the Irish government are actually making, and they are going to send one to the mayor of New Bedford and one to the mayor of Fremantle.
Oh, now I do have tears in my eyes, Margot. What a lovely thing. We'll have to make sure the Fremantle flag hangs in a very prominent position so that
We
people
will
see.
indeed, Michael. Calls to the mayor straight away.
Well, we're celebrating all of this now, but 150 years ago, after the Catawba was pushing out further into international waters and the Georgette and the police cutter and all of those aboard those colonial vessels were heading back in. And as I suggested last time we were talking, the recriminations would have been setting in. The inevitable official inquiry was going to happen and fingers were going to be pointed. You wouldn't want to have an Irish name, I think, about that time if you had been working at the prison or for the governor, or you wouldn't want to have an Irish name. You'd be implicated by name, sort of thing, Margot. So what did happen immediately afterwards, so far as the colonial authorities, the establishment authorities down there at the convict establishment, what happened?
So, listeners will remember that it was Easter Monday when they escaped, and that Controller General Fauntleroy was in Perth attending the regatta. And then Martin Hogan had been painting the veranda on Fauntleroy's residence, and he was under the supervision of Ludlow, Warder Ludlow. Ludlow was also in charge of the second party, and if we remember, they were cleaning chimneys inside Fauntleroy's house. And of course, Fauntleroy was most insistent that Ludlow keep an eye on those chaps inside his house. So at 9:20, Lidlow came out to see how Hogan was going with the painting and found that he was missing. He immediately reported it to the gate. And at 9:35, the gatekeeper, Lindsay, reported to Superintendent Doonan, who was in charge, that Hogan had escaped and that a report needed to be made to the police. An inquiry soon revealed.
Oh, I can't believe it. I mean, I'm worried for Doonan. It sounds like a good Irish name to me, but they've got onto the job straight away, so they
They
weren't
got
hanging around.
no, 5 minutes and they were away doing it. So they, alerted everyone. You can imagine the whistles blowing, the kind of bells ringing, everything happening up there at the prison. And then, of course, they realised that the rest of the other five were missing as well. So the six Fenians are gone.
Now, you've reminded us all that the regatta's going on, the brilliant planning around the regatta, and Fauntleroy's there, but so's the governor, Governor Robertson. Do they get
That's
to
right.
hear?
Yep. So by 1 p.m., Robinson and Fauntleroy had been informed and they left the regatta and made their way to Fremantle. Now, it would have taken a while, to get down here. So Robinson took personal charge of the attempts being made to recapture the prisoners. They had a report back from Rockingham and they knew that the Fenians were on board the whaleboat.
Well, that ties in very nicely with everything we've talked about. So the advice on the land to the highest authority, the governor, Robinson, was that they've got away, they've been spotted on a whaleboat, and they're obviously heading out to sea. So does the governor panic?
Well, he immediately commandeers Georgette, the reliable Georgette, the faithful Georgette. It's the only boat available to him to go out in pursuit of the Catalpa. And he orders it to sea, and it eventually sailed from Fremantle that evening. Now, of course, it had to be commandeered, it had to be fitted out, all the pensioner guard had to get on board. Superintendent Stone had to be called up from the water police. So this all took a while. And of course, we had Captain O'Grady, who was the captain of the Georgette. And he said, "Look, I need time to fuel up with coal." And they went, No, there's no time. No, we've got to get going." So,
We have to remember that she's a steamer, not just a sailing ship.
correct, a steamer. And that would, if she was just a sailing ship, she possibly wouldn't have been able to catch up with the Catalpa.
O'Grady must have put a few one and ones together and come up with two by this point. He's the brother-in-law of Mary Tondet. He met Captain Anthony, knew Breslin around the traps. I wonder how he was thinking and feeling at that point. And he was having to worry about the fuel supplies.
Well, I suspect that O'Grady would, when he offered once apparently that he needed to fill up with fuel, and when they said no, I suspected he just thought, "Well, we'll find out."
So what about the governor? The governor doesn't jump on board, does he?
No, he doesn't. He puts Stone in charge, and then of course at 10 o'clock that night. Coxon Mills comes back from the police cutter. Remember, the police cutter had actually seen the prisoners get on board the Catalpa, and he reports, "Look, they're actually out to sea, and I couldn't catch them. The wind came up, and anyway, I think they were probably far enough out to be not in territorial waters." So the governor returned to Perth because, of course, he had to make his dispatch to the colonial secretary. And he left Fauntleroy in charge. And so it was Fauntleroy who sent the Georgette out a second time.
Now that's important for everyone to remember. Georgette goes for the second time, and it's Fauntleroy having him put in charge of his right. Get out and get him, even though the concern is, of course, that they're already in international waters and they can do very little. Now we know that the Georgette came up for this sort of second encounter with the Catalpa, and it was early in the morning on the 19th of April, and Stone, as you say, is on board. He's the superintendent of the water police. We'll hear a bit more about him later. But what does he assess?
Well, he assesses that they are actually in international waters, and he tries, of course, he shoots over the bow of the catalpa to try and frighten them, and that threw a whole bunch of water up around the catalpa. But then he then assessed that really he didn't when of course when Anthony Hall the Stars and Stripes and said, if you fire on me, you're firing on the United States of America, then it's pretty dicey circumstances that they're in, really, isn't it?
Well, Robinson and Fauntleroy must have then been sitting around, not really a fire at that time of the year. It might have been a cool Easter, but having a sip of sherry, looking for something stronger, recalling that they've been told that there might be some sort of escape plan being hatched, and they needed to be on the lookout. And we've commented on that in the past. So, what about Robinson? He must have been quite.
Yeah, well, he was in a pretty difficult situation, really, wasn't he? Because he was the ju had to be the judge of the action of his subordinates, but he was also the head of the administration, and he had to take responsibility for what had occurred. So he needed also to justify his actions, particularly in the light of the warning, because just 5 days earlier, he'd written to Lord Carnarvon saying, and I quote, that the eight Fenians who are in prison will be carefully watched by the Controller General, and I think I may assure your lordship that any scheme of the nature referred to will end in total failure.
Oh, be careful what you commit to writing in life, Margot. Oh, letters, emails, text messages. Be very, very careful. My goodness. Now, just remind our listeners, because we haven't made a big thing of eight political Fenians here.
Correct.
Who were the other two and where were they?
Okay, well, the other two were, we had mentioned them before in an earlier podcast. So we had the six who escaped, and then the other two were Delaney and Keeley. Delaney was actually in confinement at the time. He was in solitary confinement, so he couldn't have been, he wasn't out on a work party. And Keeley was not trusted by the remainder of the Fenians. They thought he was too close to the prison governor, and they thought that he just couldn't keep his mouth shut, basically. So they couldn't risk telling him any of the plans that were going on.
Well, that was a dicey exercise, just keeping him out of the loop, I suppose. Well, I mean, they still want to let the authorities know, I imagine. There'd be sort of telegraphic communications going here, there, and everywhere within the British world to alert people to the fact that the Catalpa had been in town and had stolen their prisoners.
Indeed. so one of the things that they did is that the police here, the chief officer of the police department in Western Australia, immediately dispatched a letter to the officer in charge of the police department in New Bedford.
That's good thinking, isn't it? The
It is.
police was straight onto it. This boat, they know because of all of the paperwork. His home port is New Bedford. We'll let them know if they're turning up that they've got the crooks on board.
That's right. And guess who was the chief of police in New Bedford?
Constable Plod.
Henry Hathaway.
Henry Hathaway. Just remind our listeners who Henry Hathaway was.
Henry Hathaway had previously been on board the whaler that had rescued John Boyle O'Reilly. He'd been the first mate on that whaler. He became a lifelong friend of John Boyle O'Reilly, and he was the very man who introduced John Devoy to Captain Anthony.
And he gets this missive from Western Australia, the head of the police, warning him about all of this. Oh, I can only imagine what happened with that
Giving their
notification.
names, details of height, eye colour, the whole lot, and of course, he duly filed it into the waste paper.
That'll be a great moment in the movie as well, Margot. That Hathaway takes the piece of paper, screws it up in one hand, tosses it between the two of them, and then takes a basketball-like throw and lands it in the waste paper bin and gets on with his other work. Well, Who starts blaming everyone? Does Fonda always say,
Okay.
not me, Robinson, go off on the fishing trip?
Well, Michael, you and I have both been in organizations where things go wrong, and blame is the first thing that comes out, isn't it? So initially, Robinson blamed Fauntleroy. He stated that he had been in constant communication with Fauntleroy, who right up to the previous day reported no attempt to communicate with any of the prisoners or no appearance of a plot. And he sought the colonial secretary's approval for his decision that the Catalpa should not be fired on. So he was a bit worried that, he maybe the colonial authorities might think that he should have fired on it, but of course they actually supported. They didn't want an incident with the Americans.
I didn't really need to send the Georgette out for a further exercise, already knowing that it was in international waters.
That's correct. Yeah. So he was okay with that. And then as time moved on, Robinson cooled his criticism of Fauntleroy. So then the next person was the assistant superintendent, who was basically the warder in charge of the prison, was Joseph Doonan.
Well, we've mentioned him already, and I've just commented how he's got a good Irish name. Doonan, he's probably implicated by name. What happens to him?
Okay, so he was, of course, referred to as the Irishman, and often people will make assumptions that it was a bit of an inside job, he helped them. But I've during the podcast series, I've come across the thesis written by his great-great-grandson, and he describes Doonan as being an ultra-loyalist Protestant born in Northern Ireland in 1831, who appeared to arrive in Western Australia with the same intact and unquestioned sectarianism and political views that were endemic in his homeland.
He hated the Irish, at least if they were Catholic.
Well, he was a loyalist. He was a loyalist Protestant. That's, where he
Not
was.
all Fenians were Catholic, but a good number of them were.
Yes. One in the escape group wasn't. Yeah.
So it's interesting. He's having to protest his innocence, and his great grandson's been doing it for him since, which is commendable, because it's very easy to get a bad name for all the wrong reasons. But is there an official inquiry?
Yes, well, there is an official inquiry, but and before that, Doonan had been described as the most trustworthy and deserving subordinate officer of the service, as well as qualified to take charge of any convict prison or depot. So he's very highly regarded. Now, in the official inquiry which took place, and who should we have as the acting colonial secretary at the time but Anthony O'Grady Lefroy and A.R. Thompson, and a visiting magistrate, J.G. Slade, and they were the three official people at the inquiry. And they found that the rules of the prison had been departed from in the case of all the absconders but Hogan. So Lindsay, the gatekeeper, had permitted Cranston, Hassett, and Durra all to pass out without any authority. And Warder Buller, he was the one down on the wharf with Wilson and Harrington, he'd permitted them to leave the gang just on the oral request of Cranston. But he was absolved of any special blame because actually that was the practice. If someone, Cranston was a constable, and if he came down and said, "We need these two fellows to come and do something else," in the scheme of things, that usually how, it's Fremantle, it was pretty, everybody knew everybody. It was,
It's all brilliantly worked out, and what normally happened on the day. What about Warder Lidlow?
So Warder Lidlow, he'd overseen the two parties working at the residence, and he was also absolved because he had been left without the possibility of effectively guarding the people inside and the people outside. I mean, you can't divide yourself,
Well,
can you?
when you have these official inquiries, and over time I've been involved in a few, people sort of give up trying to make people a particular scapegoat and start blaming the system. It was all
That's
hopeless.
right.
Needs changing. What about here?
Oh, that's it. So their conclusion was that it was a lax system, and in some matters of prison discipline, that messages had been transmitted by prison constables with far too much freedom, and that too much had been left to the discretion of the warders.
Well, So what was the upshot? Did the board make any recommendations?
Yeah, they made a few that to increase the responsibilities of the gatekeeper. And I have to say that that's still working at Fremantle Prison now. If you go up to visit any of the staff there, have to sign in and sign out. And the authorising all comings and goings, and that there needed to be a better definition of responsibility for both the assistant superintendent and the acting controller general. But despite Robinson's initial damning report, Fauntleroy got off lightly, although he was certainly embarrassed because remember, he was the one who authorised for Mr. Collins to go around and have a look inside the prison.
Well, I must have been embarrassed beyond belief, but I'm still worried about poor old Dernan despite everything. I think there's in one of the Perth suburbs between Fremantle and Perth. There's a Doonan Road. I wonder if it's named after him. He may have been rehabilitated with a street name.
Well, there used to be a street named after him, which is the street along Holsworthy Street, along beside the prison. And after this event, it was changed from Doonan Street to Holsworthy Street.
Well, that goes to show you, doesn't it? That he suffered. So he must have felt it, did he?
He did indeed. So on the 10th of May, before the board had finished their sittings, he appealed for personal protection against an attempt which appears to have been made of damaging his character. And he said, and I'll quote, "I have incurred not only the hostility of the prisoners, but also of many of the warders." So on the 14th of June, he was put on a month's sick leave, suffering from alienation of mind. So they were basically blaming him for, oh, he's making it up or he's doing this.
He was a he should have been put under a suicide watch, and I suppose that's what was happening here.
Yeah, well, he should have been because he actually did attempt to take his own life.
Oh, did he? Well, what he wanted to do at that point, I suppose, is just get away from it all.
I think so. And he was clearly under enormous pressure. Remember, they'd already stated that what a brilliant officer he was. So he requested then to have leave on half pay until retirement, and that wasn't approved. Instead, Fauntleroy informed him that he had was to be retired on a pension of $115 per annum.
Which
But being,
probably wasn't a bad resolution in financial terms.
well, being an enterprising and diligent man, he made the best of that, and he built up a very successful drapery and grocery business and built a fine house in Adelaide Street in Fremantle, just across the road from St. John's Church. And he died in 1888.
Oh, well, that's something. So he goes into business. I'm feeling though for the two Fenians, even though they weren't trusted, Keeley and his mate. What became of them? Delaney.
Okay. So all immediately, there are a few other Fenians, civilian or military, who were out on ticket of leave at the time. They were all immediately rounded up and returned to prison. Just on principle. And so retribution on the two remaining military Fenians, Keeley and Delaney, was swift. Their ticket of leave was cancelled, and elaborate precautions were taken when another American whaler, the Namaoli, appeared off the coast shortly
You
afterwards.
can imagine the panic. The guns would have been firing, the whistles blowing, everyone standing down at the roundhouse with their telescopes. And another American whaler's here. Did they have anything to worry about?
Well, they didn't really, because it took another year for James Keeley before he was released on conditional pardon. But after his release, he still complained about being constantly harassed by the authorities. He married Marianne Roach in Guildford, and they had several children before he finally received a royal pardon in 1905. So
Oh my goodness, years and years later. And what about Delaney?
Delaney remained in Western Australia until 1882, when he sailed out on the Rob Roy for Melbourne and then went on to America, where he settled and raised a family. And in 1972, his great-grandson, James Delaney, held the position of the chief legislative assistant in the Congress of the US House of Representatives.
Isn't it lovely to have these little bits and pieces to know what happened to people, that people had proper lives later, and in a sense put all of this behind them. Margot, talking about US, of course, that's where the catalpa was headed. And we had the big bunch that we've talked about on board. We had the crew, of course, who'd largely been kept ignorant about what was happening when they left New Bedford. They thought they were going whaling. And even when they picked up the six military Fenians here in Fremantle, they still seemed to be unaware of what was really going on. So what happened on the Catalpa? How did it all work out?
Well, they were actually kept, and that was a deliberate policy of Anthony. So Anthony decided that it was much better if the crew were kept in the dark, so that if the Catalpa was captured, then they could truthfully say they knew nothing about it. And that was, and again, his Quaker principles come through here. He wants to protect his men. And it was only after the crisis had passed that they learnt that from the start, it had been a humanitarian effort. So now Catalpa was free, and with the ship's complement had increased from 10 to a total of, it had increased by 10, and now it was 33 people on board.
Now, after this was all over some time later, everybody wanted to, like they still do these days, to go on 60 Minutes or a 7:30 report in Australia or Australian Story or get a publisher and write a book, including I think some of the people who were just the crew on the Catalpa who had views about what happened.
Okay, so this crew member called Frank Perry, he actually, we have some of his writing. So he told us that the initial reaction of the newcomers to their environment was favourable, and he quotes, "The liberated prisoners, to a man, wept with joy and hailed the captain of the bark as their redeemer."
Is that lovely? But while all this is happening, I mean, the Brits must have been getting upset. I mean, one of the great British prime ministers is Disraeli, at least in the UK and Britain, he's thought of as a great statesman. Did he have any time for Fenians?
Well, he didn't. So on the 22nd of May in that year, so remember, it's the 17th of April they've left here. This is the 22nd of May. The Catalpa's out to sea, doesn't know anything about this. But there'd been a petition hoping to get some pardon for the military Fenians, who also didn't know anything about what was going on here. And included in those were the escaped people from Fremantle, and that was rejected. Rejected by the British Parliament.
Oh golly, oh golly. Now, when they came out on the Catalpa, the crew did do some whaling. Were they meant to do whaling on the way back?
Yes, they were, because that was the instructions from Devoy to Anthony and Breslin, was to do whaling on the way back, and that way they could make the money to offset the expenses. It's a very expensive exercise, this Catalpa. And so on the 20th of July, they spotted whales, lowered the boats, but unfortunately didn't, it was to no avail. They didn't, weren't able to do it. However, this brought about some discontent.
Well, just remind the line of the journey for our listeners. They're heading back essentially for New York slash New Bedford, a little bit further up the eastern coast of the US. To get there, I'm assuming they're sort of heading back the way they came, that is, heading towards the Cape of Africa, past Cape Town, not dropping in anywhere, don't avoid all British ships. And then try and get favourable winds and take them back to North America. Is that roughly it?
That's correct. That's correct. But after they passed the Cape of Good Hope, they were hoping to kind of head, their original plan was to head into Florida, which, if you look on the map, is quite a bit further south than New York or New Bedford. So that's where, and they were planning to go there, get a good reception there. The people in Florida would inform the people in New York that they were arrived. There'd be preparation for a big celebration, etc. That was, and also they could catch the North Atlantic whaling that way as
Yeah.
well.
Well, as we keep learning in life, you might have plans, but you sometimes have to be ready to change your plans. I could imagine that people on board, with all of this starting to come out, are responding to a different sort of emotional environment and perhaps even want to just get cracking, give up whaling, and get home, get back to the US.
And then there's always someone. who's on in a group who'll stir the discontent. And we remember our friend Brennan. So they hadn't been at sea a fortnight when Brennan was informed by one of the ex-prisoners, sorry, when Breslin was informed that Brennan was about going to cause him mischief on board this ship.
Now,
And
our listeners all remember, but let's remind them how, in a sense, Brennan had been dismissed from all considerations all the way along, but somehow or another kept turning up like a bad penny.
he did. So he wanted to Gough, who was one of the group who raised the money for the expedition, wanted Brennan to go on board. Devoy would have only one, and Captain Anthony said we can only take one Irishman because the Irish aren't a whaling nation, will be suspicious. We need the normal whaling crew. They took Duggan as the carpenter. And Anthony was absolutely dead set against Brennan, left him on the wharf in New Bedford. Brennan then took a boat to the Azores and tried to join them, then missed them by a day. So then he went off to, took a boat up to Liverpool, a boat down to Albany, came up and bumped into Breslin and Anthony on the dock in Bunbury. And then, of course, Breslin thought, well, he's here. We've got to, make the most of him. We better to have him inside the church than out. And so kept him. And so Brennan ends up, of course, then on the
On
Catalpa.
the Catalpa, no doubt claims that he's been instrumental in orchestrating the whole thing. So what seeds of discontent is Brennan sowing on board the Catalpa?
Well, it seems that Brennan might have always been a bit jealous of Breslin. So Brennan gave the ex-prisoners to understand that he was of great importance in Clan na Gael and that Breslin was some sort of interloper. Now Duggan was also informed. Duggan also informed the mate that Brennan had a higher position in the organisation than Breslin.
Oh, so Duggan bought what Brennan was selling.
So Duggan Duggan told the ex-prisoners that there'd been so much food on board for them all, and there was this and that, and then that, Captain Anthony had traded it all with other ships or given it to his crew, and that this was Breslin's fault and Anthony's fault. So they were basically breeding discontent.
And so, how did our six Fenians respond to all of this?
Well, they. These are men who've just come out of incarceration. They've been quite institutionalized. Harrington declared that he'd been better treated on board the convict ship, where they gave him a glass of wine every day.
Oh, yeah. And what
And
about the others?
Hogan said that the cook refused to supply him with boiled onions.
Oh, quite right. You're in close quarters.
And Darrow was the only one who showed the common sense and said that they should stay out longer and try and catch whales.
Well, it's a little bit tough, isn't it? They're not whalers, they're military Fenians and so on. I mean, do they come across anybody on their travels like they did on the way there?
Yeah, well, the first ship that they sighted was a week later, so this was kind of, probably 3 or 4 weeks out from Fremantle, and they Captain Anthony wanted to try and have a gam with that ship so that he could get hold of, he needed sugar and molasses, and so he signaled to go and meet with them. And as soon as that happened, James Wilson came to Breslin and asked if he could be put ashore, and if that ship was heading for an American port, because it flew American colours, he wanted to be put on that ship. But Breslin felt that he needed to keep them all together and he didn't want any of them to be arrested on the high sea, which was highly probable. And that he really wanted them to stay on board the Catalpa and that they would head on. So later that afternoon, then Brennan, Duggan, and Desmond confronted Breslin, complaining of the food and the men had ill health. And Breslin, of course, refuted these claims. Now we remember that Breslin had worked, he'd worked in Dublin in the Richmond Prison Hospital. So he knew about ill health, he knew about men who, were suffering and men who weren't. And he stated that every man on board had actually improved in appearance since boarding the Catalpa. And finally, Brennan, even Brennan agreed with that.
Even
But,
Brennan, oh well, that's something.
however, Breslin tried to reason with them to the best, and said that, look, they could make all this money for Clan na Gael to help offset the expenses. And that whaling would actually, cause the whole thing to be self-sufficient, really, which was always Richardson's intention. But Brennan was insistent that they needed to go to America, and that they needed to that there was plenty of money in the Clan na Gael coffers in America, and anyway, that the Clan na Gael would want all these men at the convention that was coming up. But we think that perhaps Brennan might have been the one who wanted to show them off as his wonderful achievement at this convention.
So what eventually happened? I'm feeling for Breslin here. There's a plan. They're meant to be following a certain way of doing things. Devoy has pronounced this on high. Brennan thinks he's up higher. But do they buckle?
They come with to Breslin with a list of demands, and these demands are that Catalpa is to abandon whaling, it's to proceed straight to the USA, and this is due to the quality of the food, the ill health of the prisoners, and the fact that that the prisoners couldn't really feel free until they're on American soil. So Breslin assembled them and asked if they understood the nature of their requests, and that they were being asked to throw away what would, in effect, be $10,000 to $15,000 that they could make from whaling, and he asked if they'd prefer to be on shore or to make the money, and they said they wanted to be on shore.
Well, I feel for the crew because they're expecting to make some money from whaling from the very first time they left port in New Bedford. So we haven't talked about Captain Anthony in all of this. I mean, he's a mild-mannered Quaker, watching all of this happening, no doubt trying to do the right thing. He's got Breslin there. He's got this mob starting to carry on. What does he do or say or think?
Well, of course, Anthony doesn't want mutiny on board, does he? No captain would want that. So, and he's a humanitarian, and he's a good leader of men. We've seen that in the way that he handled the men in the whaleboat. So he understood that years of ill treatment had left an impact on the Fenians, but he also knew that they were trained military men and they had access to guns. So what the captain did is he required that each of them were to sign the demand. And in this demand, that they would take responsibility for all losses to the owners and for Anthony's compliance with their request to head to port.
Well, that was thoughtful. Good idea to get things in writing when you need to. So, there's going to be losses to the owners because there's no whaling revenue coming in. Yeah, how's it going to work out? So you've mentioned guns, and I always thought they must have got into Jamaican Run or, as you said, New Bedford Run when they got onto the ship. I'm trusting they still had a bit of grog to drink and that everybody was being had taken the pledge to an extent, Margot.
Well, they didn't really have, because in those days, American boats were basically dry, whereas on the English boats, as they said, that on the convict ship they got a glass of wine every day. I think that was the way for the British to keep them compliant, really, just sort of dole it out a little bit at a time. In Fremantle Prison, they had quite a lot of access to alcohol, it seems, and there were a couple of reports of the Fenians and various other prisoners being drunk, and so drunk that they were falling down sometimes. So it was like we can assume that some of them were habituated to alcohol, and not having any can cause, withdrawals, really. So that would have been part of their suffering, I would imagine. Captain Anthony accepted, and he said, once he accepted, he's a great commander, Captain Anthony. He set his course for the south of Madagascar, stood well into the shores when he was rounding the Cape of Good Hope, and crossed the Agulhas Banks. And then after that, he took advantage of the currents and set the ship into the Atlantic, although he encountered several winter storms, but quickly they hit the trade winds and joined the long line of merchant ships heading across the Atlantic.
I can imagine if you're looking at the the ship tracking apps as I have been lately, particularly in the Gulf of Hormuz, the Strait of Hormuz, there'd be lots of little blue and red and green and yellow, and they'd all be heading for New Bedford for one
That's
reason or
right.
another. So, and you wouldn't want to call it in any ports like St. Helena, British.
Definitely not. No, they made it again, Anthony made a choice not to go into St. Helena because of the potential of British ships, and which was a really good decision because later they learned that there was a British warship awaiting their arrival, because a lot of ships called in there, of course, to fill up with water and provisions.
Well,
So
they head on. Their minds are all on home. And what's the how does the journey go? Do we have any mishaps?
okay, on the 10th of July, they cross the equator, and their original plan for to go into Fernandina in Florida had been changed, and so they went past Bermuda. So they're going further north when it was blowing a gale, but that blew them into the coast of the United States quite quickly, and found themselves 80 miles from Sandy Hook, just at the beginning of the New York Harbor there. And engaged an ocean tug. And the pilot was quite surprised to find a New Bedford whaler that wanted to head into New York for some reason.
It does sound very strange. So, do we know from the historical record just when they made it to New York? We're sort of talking Manhattan here.
It was Manhattan. So at 2 a.m. on the 19th of August, 1876, the Catalpa anchored off Battery Point in New York.
Well, those who have been to New York, Manhattan will know Battery Point. It must have been quite exciting. Were there people there to welcome them? Were they all pretty ignorant about this?
Well,
2 a.m. in the morning.
2 a.m. in the morning. So at sunrise, Captain Anthony and Breslin went ashore in the whaleboat and made their way to O'Donovan Ross's headquarters in Clan na Gael. But by that time, word had got out, and the Catalpa was surrounded by a flotilla of small boats, everyone coming and cheering and screaming.
Well, somebody who'd left Fremantle, and we've talked about in the past, who Governor Robinson would have been very concerned about, and no doubt his name came up in the official inquiry. Well, yeah, was William Foley.
So would he was so William Foley, of course, had arrived. William Foley had left here. He'd been the carrier of messages between Breslin and the prisoners in the prison. He'd gone on to taken a boat from Fremantle in January of that year, gone to Ireland, reported to the headquarters in Ireland what was going on in the Catalpa, and had gone and reported to Devoy and O'Donovan Ross and others. He was actually at the hotel when Captain Anthony and Breslin arrived, and they were the first person he saw.
Oh well, another moment in the movie, and you know, Anthony will have known Foley less well, but Breslin, he's the man he's been dealing with. They would have embraced, but what would he have observed?
Breslin observed he was quite shocked actually to see how much Foley's health had deteriorated. Now, Foley wasn't well when he left here, but clearly the journeying and everything that he was doing had, he was progressed. His ill health had progressed.
Now, if we turn up at Battery Point today on some boat and it comes in, we'll be surrounded by ICE officials and others in the US. They'll be demanding to see our visas and our passports and everything else. What about these guys?
So Captain Anthony, of course, had to go to the customs house and clear the boat. And so he went and got the permit for all of his crew and passengers to land. He returned to the Catalpa and he said, "Men, I have a permit for you to go ashore, and you're at liberty to go when you please."
My goodness, their ultimate freedom, and I can understand it. They just wanted to be on the land. They wanted to be in the US where liberty prevails or used to. There it is. Everybody, presumably, particularly the Irish, would be, the word must have been going like a wildfire out amongst the community.
Absolutely. The Irish know how to party and how to celebrate something. So the Fenians were taken to O'Donovan Ross's hotel, where the green flag was immediately hoisted. There was feasting and celebration, and to honour the bold Fenian men. And Captain Anthony, meantime, back on the boat, in true kind of New England style, writes in his logbook, 20th of August, 1876. Went to City Wharf, made her fast. So ends this day a pleasant voyage for J.T. Richardson.
Oh my goodness. As we've been saying in some recent podcasts, particularly with Jim Ryan, the great grandson of Captain Anthony, you can't forget Richardson in all of this. He's the father-in-law of Anthony, and he's instrumental in making this all happen. So to note him in his logbook is pretty important. And of course, in the last episode that we posted, the J.T. Richardson flag is there for all to see. It's quite something. But what about Anthony? He probably just wants a good lie down and a Bex and have a long sleep.
Well, I'm sure he wanted to get back and see his wife and his daughter as well, I'm sure. So he contacted Richardson, who told him to return by train to New Bedford and that he would arrange for a pilot to sail Catalpa up there. So a large crowd had gathered at the station, including, of course, Emma and now his toddler daughter, Sophie, and they were all there. And all of the Irish in New Bedford, they wanted to see the gallant hero.
Well, another important part in the movie embraces more tears, the little toddler Sophie being held high and thrown in the air and hopefully caught as she comes back down towards Earth. The gallant hero's there. I'm sure all he wanted was, if they didn't have hamburgers in New Bedford, something like it, and a good night's sleep and hugging his wife. So does the Catawba make its way back?
Yes, it makes its way back and arrives on the 24th of August. And the following evening, there was a lavish reception held by the local Clan na Gael to honour Captain Anthony. And Hassett was there present with him, so and as was John Boyle O'Reilly. And so
So
we
we
have.
get a Fenian, we get the great JB turning up, and JB loves to write. He loves, sometimes he's a bit flowery. Does he record what happened?
Oh, he does. Excuse me. So I'll say the words of John Boyle O'Reilly. He said, "We are here to show our gratitude to the man who has done a brave and wonderful deed, the self-sacrifice, the unfailing devotion of a man who has taken his life in his hands, beached his whaleboat on a penal colony, defying its fearful laws, defying the gallows and the chain gang in order to keep faith with the men who placed their trust in him. This is almost beyond belief in our selfish and commonplace time."
Well, you can't fault a word of what J.B. O'Reilly said there, can you? Including
No.
selfish and commonplace times. I mean, the world's exactly the same today. It's only 150 years ago, of course. Oh, golly. But we can't forget Devoy. I mean, Devoy's entitled to take a huge amount of the credit. He's the guy who actually sat like a puppet master and made these things happen. So what about him? Where was he in all of
Okay,
these celebrations?
he was when news reached him, because of course they expected them to come into Florida and have plenty of time to prepare for the celebrations. So when he was in Philadelphia at the time, he was in bed with the flu. But
Oh,
when he heard that the Catawba was in New York, he immediately got out of bed, took a train to New York. And when he saw the men that he'd recruited all those years ago, and that he looked at them and they looked like, he said, described that they looked like human scarecrows compared to the young men that he'd recruited, and he nearly sobbed. He took them into a private room, but he was distressed as all but Darrow launched into diatribes against Breslin and praised Brennan as their deliverer.
oh no. Oh, how do you deal with this? I mean, Devoy had made a big thing of getting Breslin, and he would have wanted to assess what was going on. Did Devoy was Devoy able to deal with this directly?
Devoy was a straight shooter, we know that, and he replied that Brennan was a liar. and a troublemaker, and that they owed their lives to Breslin and Captain Anthony.
Goodness. So, I mean, no one would want to have much to do with Brennan. What about Devoy?
Well, later, for a long time afterwards, Devoy became embroiled in a feud with both Brennan and Gough over finances, and he held Gough responsible for robbing Breslin of the full credit of the mission.
Oh, well, it's complicated, isn't it? Gough goes on and becomes a New York Supreme Court judge and writes a wonderful tribute, as we've heard, to Anthony when he passes away. There's obviously egos and people wanting to record their positions in history. Still goes on today. Well, let's start talking about what happened to all the rest of them, the operatives, the Fenian Six. But let's start with Breslin, being maligned by Brennan. What happens with him?
Well, he returned to New York and was the toast of the town, of course. He delivered lectures across the United States, giving a blow-by-blow account of the Catalpa affair. And he later worked with Devoy on a newly established Boston paper, The Irish Nation. He was second only to Devoy in terms of prestige among the Irish community in America. And he became heavily involved in a bid to liberate Ireland by force, if necessary, and not just politics. His work included helping an American engineer, John Holland, to push Holland's vision of building submarines capable of wreaking havoc on foreign navies. Convinced that the Royal Navy would be the ideal place to start, the submarine project was partly funded by Clandegale, and two of the trustees of the initial fund to develop the project were John Breslin and John Devoy.
Isn't this something? The name John Holland, of course, was well known as a big engineering firm in Australia. So you get this Irish American engineer, John Holland, he wants to put holes in the Brits. And of course, Breslin was going to be involved in that. How did Holland go with all of this?
Well, he was successful, and in 1881, the first submarine had been formally commissioned by the US Navy that was designed by him.
Oh, fantastic. I mean, these guys knew what they were doing. But what about on the private side? No one's mentioned Mary Tomduck yet. She's been left behind. We'll come to her, but pregnant and does Breslin send for her?
Shall we go on? Yes, Breslin. So we'll talk about Mary Tonduit. So less than a month after the Catalpa escape, the 23-year-old Mary Tonduit left Fremantle for Sydney. In a report to the West Australian Police, Thomas Rowe, remember Thomas Rowe was the Scotland Yard detective who clearly didn't do very well in uncovering what was going on in Fremantle. So he reported that, and we'll quote, Mary Tonduit, a Roman Catholic girl of this colony, late servant of the Emerald Isle Hotel, where Collins lodged, was seduced by Collins and is now pregnant. She left the colony in the schooner Northern Light. Her expenses were paid by Collins through Maloney, that's the proprietor of the Emerald Isle. And she is to remain in Sydney, where further arrangements are promised to be made to take her to Collins.
Well, isn't that interesting? He no doubt got all of his information from Maloney. Maloney probably had to tread a bit carefully in all of this because he was plainly informed about a lot of what was happening, I'd say, Margot.
He was plainly informed, but remember, Maloney was an ex-Dublin policeman, so I think he was playing the game that he knew how to play.
Well, Mary Tondat, her sister, of course, was married to O'Grady, the skipper of the Georgette. I mean, oh, I just love all of these connections. They'll be quite something. And she would have been rather distressed when Breslin went off. They must have known she was pregnant. What happened with Mary? Did she make it to Sydney?
Yes, yeah, she did. At the end of the year, Mary and John Breslin's son, John Joseph Tonduit, was born, and his baptismal certificate records that his father's name was John Joseph Breslin, which suggests that Mary knew all along what Mr. Collins's real name was, and most likely the purpose of his visit here. However, for whatever reason, we don't know why, but she did not go to America to join the father of her child. Instead, she stayed in Sydney, and in 1880 she married a local watchmaker, Henry James Thomas, and they had seven children of their own before Mary died of pneumonia in 1896 when she was 43.
Oh, golly. So do we know anything about the son?
So, yes, John Breslin's Australian son took his stepfather's last name and he settled in rural New South Wales, where he became a horse breaker, a grocer, and a leader of the town band before returning to Sydney for his later years. He died there in 1951, aged 74, and it is believed that he did not know the story of his biological father.
I find that a bit surprising, I have to say. He must have wondered where that name came from and what the circumstances were. But perhaps in those days, a young Mary didn't really want to talk about what had happened, and she might have been slightly aggrieved. Although one way or the other, she seems to have got over it. It's one hell of a story, isn't it? But what about Breslin then? If he didn't marry Mary, did he get married
He
back in
did marry.
Australia?
So in 1880, John Breslin married Teresa Brosnan, and they had two children, Madeline and Hugh. And his time to enjoy family life, unfortunately, was short-lived because he died in 1887 at the age of 50.
Oh.
His death was announced in the New York Times with a quote from John Boyle O'Reilly, who said of him that he is one of the bravest and most devoted of all Irish patriots. Leaders and members of Clan na Gael journeyed from all over the United States to New York for his funeral, which had to be delayed for an hour and a half because so many thousands of people were trying to attend.
Oh, golly, golly. Real life does intrigue, doesn't it, and all of these things. We haven't talked much about Desmond. We noted that he seemed to sort of buddied up, palled up with Brennan on the ship. He didn't seem to have all that much to do, really, with Mr. Collins. He didn't come out to Australia with Collins, Breslin, that is. And when in Fremantle, Desmond, of course, was off in Perth doing his menial trade. And then he's the next thing, he's helping them get on the Catalpa and head off. But what happens to Desmond once they get to the US?
Desmond returned to California. Remember, he came from the Californian branch of the, and where he was elected as the 12th sheriff of San Francisco in 1879. So that's only 3 years after the Catawba escape. Clearly, it was a Wild West then, and it was on a working man's ticket. So he served for one term and afterwards remained active in the Irish affairs. He died in 1910 at the age of 72.
Many of our listeners will know that in the US, just about everybody who does anything that has any sort of public element to it has to get themselves elected. So that's why he was standing on a working man's ticket to be elected sheriff of San Francisco. Sounds like a good job, but he only had it for a term. We've mentioned William Foley. He was the unsung hero, many say, in all of this, because he undetected was able to pass all the messages, keep the Six Fenians informed, and make sure that they made it to the Catalpa and escaped. You've described already that he didn't look well, and they were all a bit shocked when they saw him. What happened with him?
Okay, so it was less than 3 months after the arrival of the Catalpa that he died on the 1st of November, 1876. He was given a patriot's funeral, and the New York Herald reported that the funeral cortege was so large that it every gathered it was the largest ever gathered for an Irishman in America at the time, and his pallbearers were the six escaped Fenians.
Oh my goodness, this is another moment in the movie where the audience aren't given much music, they're just given this scene. The six Fenians are carrying the coffin. Oh, I think the tears might actually flow at that point, Margot. Speaking of the six Fenians, what about Thomas Darrow?
So Darrow initially settled in a boarding house in Philadelphia where he worked for Clan na Gael. And he'd had a wife and children before he was arrested, and he
In
was
Ireland.
finally reunited with them in America. He died at the age of 78 in 1912 and is buried in Philadelphia.
Oh, golly, and Robert Cranston.
Cranston married and settled in Philadelphia where he worked for a time as the assistant to O'Donovan Rossa and the clan. He later embarked on a cotton and woolen waste business, and in 1910 he was employed as a police night watchman. He died in 1914, aged 72, and he's also buried in Philadelphia.
It's almost stereotypical that the Irish in America or in New York or Philadelphia or Boston finish up as policemen.
That's right.
Martin Hogan.
Martin Hogan broke the mold. He moved to Chicago,
Plenty of
where
Irish in Chicago, I can tell
that's
you.
true, where he remained active in Fenian affairs. He married and had one daughter, but he had trouble adjusting to his new life after so many years in prison, and he reportedly developed a drinking problem and died there in 1901, aged 63.
There are Harringtons around the place, everywhere, Irish from Ireland, here in Western Australia. What about Michael Harrington? What happened to him?
He married 2 months after arriving in America, and he became the father of two children and served in the Central Park Police Force in New York. He was a heavy drinker, and he died in 1886, aged 60, and is buried in New York.
As you intimated earlier, there was a bit of heavy drinking, but perhaps not surprising after everything people had been through. Hassett, you mentioned he was up for a moment or three in New Bedford after the Catawba got there. What happened to Thomas Hassett?
He settled in New York as well, married an Irish American woman, and together they ran a saloon frequented by the Clan na Gael. He died in 1893, aged 52, and he's also buried in New York.
I guess people didn't live long lives in those days, but these are a little bit too short for me. And what about James Wilson, who in a sense started all of this? Well, he did. He wrote the tomb letter to
That's
Devoy.
right.
So what happened to James
So
Wilson?
James Wilson married, he had a family, and he moved to Pawtucket on Rhode Island. He was the last man standing of the wild geese who'd escaped from Western Australia, and the only one who lived long enough to see the Easter Rising in Dublin in 1916.
People will know about the Easter Rising in Dublin. This was a huge event which was going to do more than just strike a blow for freedom and for an Irish Republic. It was going to achieve it. So he saw that happen. And did he continue to be engaged in politics?
He did indeed. So in 1919, one of the leaders of that rising, and the man who became the first president of Dáil Éireann, was the late and later president of the Irish Republic, Eamon de Valera, made a trip to America. Like Wilson, de Valera had been court-martialed and sentenced to death, only to have his sentence commuted before he too made a miraculous escape from Lincoln Prison in England. So we can only imagine the conversation that went on between these two Irish patriots.
Well, and sitting like a bird up on a branch looking down on these two guys, both mixed up in similar endeavours, all fighting for a Republican Ireland, and different paths that they've been forced to follow to the meeting that they then have in new in the US. So does de Valera know about the full Catawba story?
He certainly does. De Valera made a very big point of coming to meet Wilson, and after that he went on to meet Emma Anthony, the wife of Captain Anthony, and he later went to the graveside of Captain Anthony, accompanied by Henry Hathaway, where he laid a wreath.
Oh, golly, this is another moment. It's probably not so tearful as just a lovely moment. When de Valera does that, he meets Emma, the widow of Captain Anthony, goes to the gravesite. Henry Hathaway's there, great mate of J.B. O'Reilly, and lays a wreath. Oh, how beautiful.
And Michael, when Jim Ryan was out here, he had the photo, the original photo of de Valera at the graveside of his great grandfather. And in the photo was his grandmother as a child who was there with de Valera on that day.
Oh, it just goes on and on. Well, we know that Ireland becomes an independent nation in 22, the Irish Free State, fully dependent independent state in 31, and formally the Republic of Ireland in 1949, when the vision of the wild geese came to fruition as an international state. But we can't leave any of this before we just reflect on Captain Anthony. Can you tell us a bit about what happened with him?
Okay. Well, Anthony returned, when he returned to New Bedford, of course, he could never go to sea again. He could not enter any British harbour in the world, for he would have been immediately arrested. So, one of the first things that he did was to ensure that the crew were adequately compensated, because remember, they couldn't go whaling, they were dependent on that. So, again, this shows his incredible sense of fairness. So what they did was averaged out the takings of the other vessels out of New Bedford that year, and they paid the men out that amount of money.
Remembering that J.T. Richardson commanded a bit of a fleet.
Correct. Oh, well, and of all the others, yes, yeah, correct. So the Catalpa was handed over to John Richardson, Captain Anthony, and Henry Hathaway for the sum of $1, so that it was theirs to sell as a way of a reward or for their contribution.
Because the ship had been registered in another name. Jim Ryman, he was able to show us the bills of sale whereby that $1 transaction occurred.
Correct.
What about Emma and Sophie and Co?
So Emma Anthony and their daughter Sophie had lived with her mother and father, Richardson's, while George was away on the Catalpa, as he had, and he had no job to return to. They continued to live with her parents for 4 years while he was looking for adequate work. He didn't want to go back. You can imagine after doing something like this, you couldn't go back to the drill shop, could you? The mechanical workshop, it would have been. Their second daughter was born. That's the grandmother of Jim Ryan. And he served for a while with the New Bedford Night Police until in 1886 he obtained employment as the boarding officer for the New Bedford Customs.
Well, that was a job he was well trained for, you might say.
Well, he would have known everything going on, wouldn't he?
Well, he didn't make money out of this.
No,
The Richardsons
no.
were obviously comfortable, but I mean, it wasn't as if he won the lottery by doing this. He might have put some extra jewels in his crown, but and we know he dies in 1913, but before that.
In 1909, the Connecticut branch of the Clan na Gael raised money to pay off Anthony's mortgage. So at that stage, they must have felt, here's this man who's given so much to us. He really, like a lot of people who do heroic things, you don't get the working opportunity to acquire wealth that you would do if you just stayed in an ordinary job. So it was great that the Clan na Gael did that. So Anthony died in 1913 and is buried in a Quaker grave in New Bedford. The Stars and Stripes, which he hoisted on board the Catalpa, was donated to the Irish nation and will this weekend go on display in Dublin to mark the 150th anniversary.
Oh, no, forget the movie. Just deal with the podcast. I'm sort of choked up by that. I really am. Margot, that is the most beautiful thing.
Yeah.
Together with everything said at the beginning. Oh.
So
Margot,
it's
before
amazing
we,
story.
it is an amazing story. I want to thank you. From the bottom of not just my heart, but I know all of the listeners' hearts. I've had so many commendations for the podcast series. People have loved what you've done. They've loved the way you've narrated it. You're so learned about what's happened in this story, the research you've done, and the good glosses and the way you've seen the full story and how involved you've been in the whole Fenian Festival in Fremantle over a number of years now. Thank you very much for everything that you've done and for helping to make this podcast such a success. Well done.
Well, thank you, Michael. That's lovely. And thank you very much. And thank the Shipping News for the time and energy. It's been great fun doing this podcast with you. And I think it's a fabulous Fremantle story, but also a national story and an international story. And it's really important that the people of Fremantle have an opportunity to know it and to own it. So thank you.
And we should remind people, if they're coming to Fremantle, they live here or they're around Perth, come down to Fremantle. Go to the Fremantle prison, not to be locked up there, but to see the free exhibition.
It's a fabulous exhibition that they've put together. It's outside the prison, so it's available 24/7, and you can have a look at it and read every little bit of what's gone on from the Fenians. And you know, it's a compliment to the prison staff that it's a beautiful exhibition. It'll be there till November.
Well, it only remains to say goodbye to our listeners. Thank you very much, listeners. We've really appreciated, as I said earlier, your compliments for the show. I know there are those of you who haven't been able to wait to get your hands on it each time we've made the next one, and we really are pleased that you've enjoyed it as much. And just to remind you that as we make this, and it'll be posted today as well, it's the 17th of April, 2026, 150 years after the Fenians got away on the Catalpa off the Rockingham seashore. See you for now, everyone.
Bye.